And now an inside account of the Thai cave rescue from the two Australians at the heart of it. 12 members of the Wild Boars soccer team, aged 11 to 16, and their assistant coach, entered the Tam Luang cave on the 23rd of June last year, and their ordeal began. Soon after going underground, monsoon rains swamped the cave, trapping them and triggering a major international rescue effort, which concluded 17 days later and which transfixed the world. During the mammoth rescue mission involving more than 100 divers, one of the rescuers, a former Thai Navy SEAL, died of asphyxiation while returning from delivering supplies of air. At the heart of the operation, Dr. Richard Harris, or Harry as he's best known, an Australian anaesthetist. He was part of the medical team that determined the boys' fitness to make the perilous 4-kilometre journey back to the surface, and also had to determine whether and how they would be anaesthetised. Also playing a key role, his diving partner, the veterinarian Dr. Craig Challen. Both men, in addition to their medical credentials, are cave diving specialists. They were jointly awarded the 2019 Australian of the Year. Their story is told in a book, Against All Odds, just published. I spoke just last week to Harry and to Craig about their remarkable efforts to save young lives while the world was watching, and how they both fully expected that some of the children would die during the dangerous mission. We talked about how their part of the story began.
So I was, like many Australians, becoming aware of this story as I started to see bits and pieces in the newspaper. These 12 boys and their coach lost in a cave in Thailand. They went into the cave after their soccer training on a Saturday afternoon and basically not seen again. And there was only small snippets in the newspapers to start with. And of course, as someone who's a cave diver and with an interest in search and rescue operations around cave diving, I started following the story, as did Craig. And then we heard that some British cave divers who we knew quite well, Rick Stanton and John Valanthan, had become involved. So our interest increased even further. And I started communicating with Rick quite early on. And the feeling was that this was a mission that was almost certainly going to turn up the dead bodies of these children, because the size of this flooding event that had trapped the boys in the cave almost certainly meant that the chance of them still being alive were quite small. So no one was more surprised than us when the Brits found them alive on day 9.
And Craig?
Well, similarly, really. It was, we'd not expected them to be alive, and it was never really, nothing like this had ever been done before. There's been 2 cave diving rescues in history previous to this, but they were nowhere near the scale of the events in Thailand. And when it was first suggested that there might be a cave diving rescue, thought, impossible, I'll just have to find another way. But we were happy to put up our hands to jump on a plane, go up to Thailand and do whatever we could do to help. Originally, we thought we'd probably be going up there in an advisory role. We knew the Thai military were diving in the cave, and the impression we got was that they were going to, or had the intention of, conducting the rescue. So we thought we'd just be going to offer some advice. And at that stage, we certainly threw some dive gear in, never knowing what was going to happen, but we weren't expecting really to be instrumental to the rescue like we subsequently turned out to be.
When you knew you would be going in there, you had some doubts. I think each of you spoke to your partners because of what you've just already alluded to, and the title of the book, The Odds Against This, being successful in the sense of bringing many, if any, of those boys out alive, were just so high. And did you have some doubts, or did you just have to deal with whatever the consequences would be?
Well, it was more than having doubts. We were actually completely, I guess we totally did not think it was possible. So we were convinced that there was no chance of bringing these boys out alive, whether by teaching them to dive or, as the suggestion was later made, to use an anaesthetic technique to bring them out. In fact, it was Rick Stanton who came up with that suggestion, and my initial response that that's just impossible, Rick. You can't anaesthetise someone, render them unconscious, and then immerse them underwater and bring them out through a cave for 3 hours and not expect that they're all going to drown. So we were very pessimistic about the outlook right from the word go.
Explain how the logistics were just so challenging and the decisions that were considered as a means of bringing them out. You've touched on the first two. Can you possibly teach a person to scuba dive with all its complexities in this extreme situation and in a cave, one of the most difficult environments to dive in? And then second, if you're going to try and do it another way, anaesthetise them. Why is that so, you know, incredibly risky and unlikely? Just explain to people the physiology and the psychology of what you guys were discussing.
Well, the chances of teaching them to dive seemed thin enough to start with, but we were actually told that these boys didn't even know how to swim at the time. And that subsequently turned out not to be true, and they go swimming just the same as kids the world over all the time. But that was the information that we were operating on. So the thought that we were going to teach these kids that weren't even used to being in the water how to put all this strange gear on, breathe out of breathing apparatus, and then go for what was expected to be a 3-hour dive out, not panic, in extremely hostile conditions. I mean, you could see nothing at all, really. The visibility in the water was about 10 centimetres. The cave, of course, it's not just like swimming down the middle of a pipe. It's jagged. It goes up and down and sideways. There's all sorts of projections going into the cave. You're in and out of the water. And it became really quickly apparent to us that there was no chance. I mean, if it had been a few tens or even hundreds of meters, maybe we could have carried that off. But for a 3-hour duration trip out, there was really no chance. And our opinion was reinforced by the fact that the two British divers, Rick and John, when they'd first been conducting the search for the boys, they came across some adult Thai workers that had been trapped in the cave when the water levels went up one day. And they were only on the other side of a sump that was about 15 meters long. They had to be dived out through there one by one. So that dive would have taken maybe 20 or 30 seconds or so. And two of those four guys were freaking out and panicking by the end of that extremely short dive. So that really made it very clear to us that there was no chance of getting these boys out. They would have to be brought out with help, and the anaesthetic became the only way forward.
Panic is the diver's enemy. And, you know, these boys had been in there for days and days. And that, you know, you've just explained exactly why that option just did not seem to be the solution. But what are the risks around the anaesthetic and, again, the physiology of diving and of breathing while diving? What were the risks around it and even determining doses?
Well, the first thing to know, obviously, is this is completely unprecedented. So to say even what the risks are is a bit of an unknown because no one's ever tried it before. But I could see three major problems with the plan, and any of which could, and I thought would, ultimately lead to the demise of these boys. The first one is that obviously when you're unconscious or anaesthetised in this case, you can't possibly hold a mouthpiece of any kind in your mouth, so we would have to use some kind of full face mask which would seal all around the boys' faces. And we've done quite a bit of training on this topic. We've taken people through caves in Australia pretending to rescue them, and also even practiced, you know, pretending to be unconscious. And we've found that inevitably the mask surely, slowly but surely, will fill up with water. And you don't need very much water inside the mask to drown yourself. So, you know, unless you're an active participant in the dive and you actually play a role in keeping the water out of the mask, then, you know, it seemed ultimately inevitable to me that these boys would drown inside the mask. Now, we hadn't really considered the idea of positive pressure face masks, which is a type of commercial diving mask which, as the name suggests, keeps pressure inside the mask so that if the mask fails or leaks or there's a breach in the seal, then gas will flood out of the mask very rapidly and stop water getting inside. And I think in retrospect, that was a very important part of the equipment that ultimately helped the boys survive and avoid that problem of the flooding of the mask. So the next problem I considered would be that, you know, an unconscious person needs to have their airway maintained. And even if their head flops forwards onto their chest, then their airway can be occluded or obstructed. And I thought that surely at some point during a three-hour dive, they're going to block their airway without, you know, expert people attending to them. And the British and other divers weren't medical people. So it seemed inevitable that at some point their airways would obstruct. And finally was the issue of hypothermia, that these boys were swimming through or being swum through 23-degree water, and obviously your body temperature is closer to 37. So those two temperatures are going to come together and end up in an ultimately dangerously hypothermic patient who will probably have a cardiac arrest due to the drop in temperature. So, you know, that was just the first three things off the top of my head that I was worried about, and it was inconceivable that it could work.
I mentioned the dose. Was that something else that you had to calculate, again, in an unprecedented situation, enough to calm them and prevent panic and allow the leadership that was going to happen, because they were tethered to the divers, while not overdoing it?
Well, actually, the goal was to provide them with full surgical-level anaesthesia. In other words, we wanted them to be more than sedated. We wanted them to be completely unconscious. And we looked at the idea of maybe we could just give them a bit of something to take the edge off their worries, but realised that, you know, with this very difficult cave to traverse, you know, tight restrictions, zero visibility, high-flow water, there's no way anyone who's less than fully asleep is going to manage that without, without panicking. So it was a full dose of anaesthesia, and obviously that's what I do for a living. And, you know, Craig has significant experience in veterinary anaesthesia, and the drug ketamine, which we used, is familiar to both of us. So the anaesthetic per se wasn't the issue, although, you know, giving a dose to an undernourished, slightly cold boy in Thailand is not, you know, ideal circumstances, so I won't say there wasn't some concerns around it, but I was pretty confident I could put them to sleep and we could keep them asleep. It was just how they would behave in the diving environment.
How did you rehearse this? Because there's you guys, there's the other divers as well, to whom the boys are actually going to be tethered. How did you rehearse it?
On the day before the rescue, Harry and I went for our first dive into the cave just to see what the conditions were actually like there, and also to do an assessment of the boys and just make sure they were looking healthy enough that they were actually going to be up to this trip. While we were doing that, the rest of the team was down at the local swimming pool, and they had some volunteers, kids from the swimming club there, and they got three of different sizes, a little one, a middle-sized one, and a big one, and dressed them up in all the gear that we were anticipating using the next day and swam them around in the cave, just adjusted all the gear to make sure it was working properly, balanced them out in the water so they need to have their buoyancy adjusted so they won't float straight to the top or sink to the bottom. And that all seemed to go fairly well, but there was no rehearsal of the anaesthetic itself. That was probably not really regarded as cool to anaesthetise people just for a practice session. So we just went in cold and did that and had to hope for the best.
Craig, I think you reveal in the book the extent of that emotional and mental torment, actually, because it's not just a question of bracing yourself for the fact that these boys might die. It's what decisions you might make if the first one or two attempts result in death. What did you have to mentally process and decide?
Well, we had to really consider carefully this moral aspect of what do you do if, say, we lost one or two first up? Do you actually continue? And it was a discussion that Harry and I had the night before the rescues started. Nobody else from the team was really involved in that, and it's a pretty difficult thing. You know, you start the beginning of the day and you're looking at these happy, healthy kids in front of you, and you're thinking, well, we might be just turning them into bodies and dragging them out dead at the end of the cave by the end of the day. And so we had to ask ourselves the question, if we lost one or two, would we continue or would we not be able to do that? And we didn't really reach a conclusion to that discussion. We actually had slightly different views. That I thought that even if we lost a couple, the equation hadn't changed, and the alternative was still certain death, and so we might as well continue to give them a go. And who was to know if we might have lost the first couple but then had 11 successes after that? The only way to know was to try. Harry had a slightly different view. His feeling was that he probably wouldn't be able to continue. I mean, obviously he's a doctor, and it's not really a very good thing, you know, ethically or morally, to be consigning your patients to death. But as history shows, it all turned out okay, and we weren't actually getting to a point where we had to test that. And I don't know how it would have gone. The other thing we discussed at that time as well is, if we did decide to continue after some deaths, what would we tell the boys the next day? I mean, do you just go in there and tell them that a couple of their mates died on the first attempt, but we're going to continue? Or do you look them in the eye and lie to them? And that was a very, very difficult thing. The way that discussion headed was, we thought that we probably would not tell them the truth, but it doesn't sit very comfortably with us to this day, and I'm extremely happy that we didn't have to face up to that question in real life.
Our guests are Craig Challen and Richard Harry Harris, the two Australians who were involved in this unbelievable, against all odds, rescue of the young Thai soccer players trapped in an underwater cave. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National, and this was to happen over 3 days, not all in one effort. And can you describe what it was like the first time you got to the boys? As you said, you never expected anyone would reach them and find them alive. Days and days, more than a week has passed. The first time you got to them and talked to them and began to prepare for this operation, what was that experience like?
We should remind the listeners that the boys were found by Rick and John, the two British divers, on day 9. So up to that point, those boys had nothing to eat. They were just sitting on this little bit of mud at the top of a very steep, muddy slope above the water. They were just drinking the cave water to stay alive, and they were obviously becoming pretty weak and dizzy. So after Rick and John found them, they started taking food into them for the next few days and fed them up pretty well. So by the time we saw them, the kids were in pretty good shape, and most importantly, their morale was extraordinarily good. You know, they're all almost to a boy, you know, smiling and able to wave to us. They were very excited to have new visitors the day that Craig and I arrived. But I can remember very clearly my feelings as we approached Chamber 9, where the boys were looking up to the surface, seeing the shimmer of the air above the water, and realising we're about to finally surface in Chamber 9 and get to meet these boys, which up until that point had really been a hypothetical thing, but now we were going to come face to face with them. And I was quite nervous at that point. But once we actually met these kids and saw how courageous and resilient they appeared to be, you know, they actually put my they calmed my nerves, I have to say, rather than the other way around. So they were an extraordinary bunch of guys and, you know, absolute survivors.
Do you believe that psychological state they were in was in large part the reason they survived? Although here we are anaesthetising them anyway to get them out. But was that, from a physiological point of view, again, a key factor in them surviving this?
I think the psychological factors are very important in the way people manage, you know, survival situations. You can decide to curl up in a ball and die, or you can do everything in your power to survive. And there seems to be quite a lot written about this subject, that there are survivors and there are non-survivors, and they can almost be predicted, you know, the moment the balloon goes up. If your yacht sinks and you end up in a life raft, there are people who are clearly going to do their best to survive, and there are people who might not. Now, I don't know the reasons why these boys were able to keep it together, and we didn't see them, of course, what they were doing in that first 9 days. I'm sure they had some pretty dark moments. But whether it's their culture or their religion, or whether it's the fact that they're just tough kids from the country, there's something about these boys that got them through this.
And the coach too, because the coach was with them, right, and carrying this terrible burden of having taken them in the first place. Are you aware of whether he played a key role in keeping the keeping the spirits up somehow.
I'm sure he did, and I don't know whether he took them in, to be honest, or whether he followed them in to keep an eye on them, because, you know, he was a young lad himself, really, 25 years old, part of that community. The soccer club was kind of like his family, I think, so he was as much up for the adventure as them. But once they were trapped, I'm sure he took on a leadership role. He had apparently spent 3 years as a monk, which no doubt helped him stay calm and help him keep the boys calm.
Clarify for us what decided who went first, the first boys to come out, because we said this is going to be carried out over 3 days. And what determined who came first and faced that very first test?
Yeah, well, Harry had given some instructions. The most important thing was that just some of the larger, healthier kids came out first, because we're so worried about what's going to happen on the way out. And, you know, those two 11-year-olds, they looked so fragile. There was absolutely nothing of them. One of them only weighed 29 kilos. So they're just these tiny little things. And he asked Dr. Puck, who was the Thai army doctor that was in there with the boys, to choose the order for the first four boys to come out. And Dr. Puck wanted to have nothing to do with that. So he handballed it to the coach, Coach Eck. And Coach Eck also seemed to not want to take that responsibility. So he just said to the boys, look, we're going to start tomorrow morning and want some volunteers. So best men step forward. And what the boys have told us, and they swear this is true, is that they had a bit of a meeting and they decided that the ones that lived the furthest from the cave would come out first, because they all thought that when they got out, they'd have to ride their bikes home. So they just wanted to give them a bit of a head start.
So let's talk through what's involved. It's not just a case of doing the anaesthetising and then tethering and away we go. You are going to have to re-administer a dose of anaesthetic several times through the journey, the three-hour journey. What was, as best you can describe it to people, what was involved, having kitted these boys up and all the gear, the buoyancy jacket and the harnesses and the mask? What was the slow and patient, high-risk journey like?
Well, we are lucky to say that we didn't have to partake in the whole journey. We were able to hand off the boys to these British divers. So I stayed in Chamber 9, the far end of the cave where the boys are. The boys would be presented to me already dressed in a wetsuit. They'd come down and sit on my lap. I'd give them the injection of the anaesthetic drug ketamine as an injection through their wetsuit into their thigh muscle. They drift off to sleep over about 5 minutes. Myself and one of the British divers would finish dressing them in the full face mask and get them nice and neutrally buoyant in the water. And then the British diver, one diver, one boy, would pretty much journey from there all the way out to Chamber 3, which was the end of the diving part of the cave. And Craig was situated in Chamber 8, so the next spot down the line. So the British diver had to take the boy about 300 metres underwater, about a 20-minute dive, through to where Craig was. And then Craig and some other guys would manhandle the boy along some dry passage, some sand and rocky sections and some low water, and then redress the boy and set him and the British diver off on the next leg. And pretty much from that point on, the British diver was on his own with the boy, with some support divers stationed along the way for the next couple of kilometres.
So the divers did the sedating every 45 minutes, gave them the next sedative, the next dose?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the first top-up was usually in Chamber 8, and Craig was able to either administer that or supervise the British guys doing their first injection. Because remember, these guys aren't doctors in any way, shape or form. They're, you know, you've got a retired fireman, a rope access worker, a couple of IT guys. And so even just giving an injection for these fellas was a big challenge the first time. And, you know, the fact that they stepped up to do this is pretty remarkable testament to their courage.
We should say the Thai authorities gave you a waiver so that if anything happened to these boys, you wouldn't be legally accountable.
Well, diplomatic immunity, yeah.
But the other thing that just occurs to me is exactly what you've just said. These divers, would they know if something happened to these kids on the way? Like, they are tethered, they are doing a complicated dive themselves, they've got all this on their minds. I mean, it's extraordinary. But when would they know whether or not they'd been successful?
Well, there was really no monitoring of the boys on the way out. The only way they could tell that the boys were still alive was if they stopped breathing themselves and just listened, and they could hear the bubbles or feel the bubbles coming against their face from the boy that was below them. And that was all they had. I mean, there was certainly no expensive anaesthetic monitoring equipment or anything other than just checking they were still breathing. But in a way, that sort of didn't make any difference, because if anything went wrong underwater, there's nothing they could do.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as underwater CPR. And without help in, you know, muddy water where they couldn't see anything at all. So the instructions to the divers were just to keep going. If anything went wrong, swim as fast as you can, get out, and you know, hopefully boys are still alive at the end of that. And for us further into the cave, well, we had no idea what's happening once we've sent these boys down the line either. They're just going at around about 45 minutes or so intervals. And these kids could have been drowning 10 metres after they left us, for all we knew. It wasn't until we got out that night. So on the first day, we got out between 7 and 8 at night. And it was only once we got back to Chamber 3, which was our dive base, that we found out that they'd all made it out.
7 p.m, I think, the first reports came out. This is the 8th of July, that the first two boys had come out alive. So you find out the first day had been successful. You must have been torn. You're just ecstatic about that, but thinking two more days and eight more boys, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long first day. And the added problem we had was that it turns out we probably got bad air in our cylinders on the first day. So, you know, I remember swimming into the cave that first rescue day and thinking, boy, yesterday must have really knocked the stuffing out of me, because I feel terrible. You know, I was cold and shivery. I had a headache. Couldn't really concentrate, and I was just thinking, boy, I'm just not up to this. Anyway, I met up with Craig a bit further in the cave and told him I was feeling pretty awful, and he said, that's funny, I've got a really bad headache. I never get headaches when I'm diving. And one by one, the British guys all admitted that they also were feeling a bit off, and we worked out that, you know, the tides had been filling so many cylinders for all this rescue that they'd run out of filters, and someone either hadn't noticed or hadn't checked, and turns out that we'd been a bit poisoned on that first day. And it would have been a pretty bad start if they'd wiped out the whole rescue team. And anyway, the next day I remember thinking to myself, I'm back. You know, I feel like a lion today compared to yesterday. So that was reassuring. I wasn't as old and unfit as I thought.
What was happening? Because pacing over the 3 days was, I presume, a realistic safety mechanism, and also recognising the limits, of course, the physical limits of the divers. But what was happening with the risk of further rains and flooding? Were you up against the clock?
Yeah, well, there's this constant pressure on us because we knew this rain was coming, and we'd been so fortunate that after the initial flooding event on the 23rd of June, that the rains had backed off because that rain had come much earlier than was really expected. It's not until sometime in July that it usually appears and floods the cave. So that pressure was on us all the time, and you know, every night it was raining to some degree. We were staying in a little hotel down the road, and I can remember lying in my bed at night and just listening to the rain on the roof and really wondering if that was the night that it was going to flood and we'd get down to the cave in the morning and the flow would be too strong for us to get back in. And at that point, we might as well just pack up tools and go home. There was nothing more that we could do for these kids. But happily, that didn't happen. We had to just work as fast as we could in anticipation of that rain coming. But the reason that we went over the 3 days was twofold. First of all, we only had a certain amount of manpower. So the divers that were on site, there were 6 divers in the core team and then another 8 in the support group around them, and it took all of those working pretty hard to conduct this job over that period of time. But the second thing was that we had a limited supply of the specific face masks that we wanted to use with these boys as well. So the positive pressure face masks, so the gas will flow in them even if there's no breathing going on at the time. And although we had many dozens of masks that had been brought to us, there was only this small number that was suitable for the job. So that's why we had to spread it out.
things got quicker, got streamlined, got quicker. And let's just be clear, when did we know all the boys were out? Was that the 9th or the 10th of July? Because, of course, the divers were the last to complete, and I know things began to get a bit hairy towards the end there. An emergency began to arise. But when did we know all the boys were out?
Well, I don't know when you knew, but I knew when I brought the last one out through the last sump. So boy number 13 turned out to have some issues because the British diver who was bringing him out lost the line in the fourth sump in the cave. And I came across this guy. He'd just been lost off the line for about 15 minutes, and the boy had started to wake up. The British diver wasn't sure whether he was ever going to retrace his steps back to an air chamber, so he'd had a real fright. And I came across him and the boy as I was exiting the cave. And because the Brit looked a bit shaken, I said, well, look, let me take the boy through the last dive, and you stay here and, you know, gather your thoughts and come out when you're ready. So I had the privilege, I guess, of taking that last boy out through to chamber three, where the receiving party of medical staff and so forth were. And so I was able to hand him off and realised that that was the end of the mission, and everyone was out safely apart from the Navy SEALs who had to follow.
When was there a moment? It's funny, the last chapters all tell a story of against all odds. Last out, call home, high fives. probably sums it up. But for each of you, when was the moment where you thought, my God, we've actually pulled this off, we've actually done this?
Oh, we'd never allowed ourselves to think that until the end of the last day. Mm. After the first day, there was certainly a sense of relief. We came to the realisation that this stupid scheme was actually possibly going to get these boys out alive, which we'd had no confidence of until that time. So we at least knew it was possible, but we did not relax. It was very real possibility that we would still have some casualties over the next few days. And in a way, it would have been even worse. You know, after the four successes of the first day, if we'd had some deaths after that, it would have been even more of a letdown, I think. So there was no relaxing and allowing it to happen. But after we got out on that last day and we knew that everybody was okay and waking up fine, yeah, that was certainly like the weight of the world off our shoulders.
It was the weight of the world off your shoulders. And just listening to you, I mean, obviously you knew the whole world. I doubt there's anything that's had eyeballs from just about every country on earth, perhaps other than a football World Cup, as concentrated on one event at one time. But listening to you, I don't get the sense that that was necessarily weighing on you, the fact you were in the spotlight. You're just too focused on what you had to be focused on. Or am I wrong about that?
Were you no, very you're, absolutely, aware? You're yeah. absolutely right. We were very focused on what was going on. But to be honest, we were also equally oblivious of the size of this story internationally. You know, we'd seen a lot of journalists around the cave outside, but to our untrained eye, they mostly looked like local people, Thais. And so we thought, oh, well, obviously this is a bit of a story in Thailand. But we actually had no idea of the size of the global impact this story was making. And it wasn't until I got home, actually, and got a message from a friend of ours who is another diver who was in Russia for the World Cup soccer, which was going on at the same time. And he told us that the soccer was kicked off the front page of all the Russian newspapers, and there was only pictures of this little soccer team in Thailand. I thought, well, that is big. If you can get sports off the front page of the paper, you're in the spotlight.
Why did it have that impact? Have you reflected on it? Why did so many people attach themselves to these boys' fate?
Well, there's so many aspects to this story. I mean, for a start, it's the good news story of the decade, really, isn't it? Rarely do you get something where the odds seem absolutely insurmountable and we're heading towards certain disaster, and then all of a sudden we snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, as the saying goes, and get this wonderful outcome. And we have no illusions that if we hadn't got all of those people out alive, that it wouldn't have been, you know, we wouldn't have found ourselves in this strange situation that we find ourselves in, where we've become some sort of minor celebrities, and we're going around telling this story, we would have melted off back into insignificance, and it would have been a footnote in history. But it's just such a great story for the outcome, and also for this international commitment to getting these boys out. I mean, there were thousands of people there that had come from all around the world, and everybody was united in a common purpose. I think it's
extraordinary cooperation.
It's a real metaphor for human spirit.
We've sort of skipped across a lot of the decisions and discussions and who had authority. We've skipped over that a little, but it's detailed in the book. But it's an extraordinary act of international cooperation, just focused on one simple priority, to save some young boys' lives. Has it changed you, without getting too deep and meaningful about it, has what you've achieved here, I mean, you're both in your professions, you win some, you lose some, you see people losing people or pets they love, and you aren't always going to win. But experiencing something like this, has it changed either of you?
I'll speak for myself. I don't think it's changed me, and I can say actually I don't think it's changed Craig either. We were up for this challenge. We've spent our lives unknowingly perhaps training for this event. Working most of my life in medicine, and even longer enjoying this passion, which is scuba diving and then later on cave diving. I felt like this was kind of a bespoke rescue for me. It was almost tailor-made for my life skills, and I was that guy before this rescue, and so I don't feel like it has changed me, to be honest. What has changed us is all the attention that's come our way afterwards, and our lives are kind of unrecognizable from 18 months ago, but it's been a kind of exciting time. It's been a lot of fun, to be honest.
Craig?
Yeah, look, we're both old enough and ugly enough to have been around the traps for a while, and I think we're cynical enough not to let something like this get to us. But it's certainly a very strange experience when you're just a couple of ordinary blokes with admittedly an unusual hobby, but apart from that, we're just anyone you could meet walking down the street. And then all of a sudden this momentous event happens that we find ourselves at the centre of, and then the bizarre consequences that have followed, where we're the centre of all this attention, and even now, 16 months afterwards, it's daily there's things happening to remind us of this. And it's been a fantastic experience, going round and getting to tell this story to people, and people really do seem to get this sense of uplift from hearing the story.
Well, Craig Challen and Richard Harry Harris, the two divers, one an anaesthetist, that's Harry, the other a veterinarian, that's Craig, the two Australians who were so central to this extraordinary rescue. As I said, it had the world transfixed. And the story of the Thai Cave Rescue is told in their book, just published, Against All Odds. It is nearly 14 minutes to 11, Penguin Random House, the publishers of the book, by the way.